From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The IMF released a report this week warning that the danger of a global economic slowdown is again, quoting them, alarmingly high. The risk of a recession, 15% for the U.S. in 2013, but 80% for Europe, rising beyond and intertwined all over. No one is immune. Everyone wants to avoid it. But how? This hour, On Point, as Obama, Romney, Brussels, and Beijing debate a stark new warning of another global recession and how, maybe, we might avoid it. You can join the conversation. Can you see the risk of the whole world tumbling back again over the U.S. fiscal cliff and more? How do we find our feet, find the right path now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The IMF meeting this week, today in Tokyo. Chief economist there, Olivier Blanchard, spoke about the new IMF report about a global slowdown. He pointed to three drivers headed down.
The first one is fiscal consolidation in advanced countries. Now, as we know, it's needed, but it's slowing growth. The second is uncertainty about what policymakers are going to do, political uncertainty, if you want, both in Europe and mainly in Europe at this point, but also in the US, in Japan. And then the third is a slowdown in emerging markets, in the main ones, China, India, Brazil.
There it is right there. Put it all together. You've got Europe, US, Japan, China, India, Brazil, and warnings of alarmingly high risks of a new downturn. Joining me in the studio right now is Simon Johnson, professor of global economics and management at MIT's Sloan School of Management, former chief economist himself at the International Monetary Fund, which issued the new warning this week. His books include White House Burning and 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and The Next Financial Meltdown. Simon Johnson, welcome. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Washington is Joseph Gagnon. He's senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, author of Flexible Exchange Rates for a Stable World Economy. Joe Gagnon, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, good to be here.
Simon, first to you. Now, here we had the bust. We tumbled. There's been so much pain. At a certain point, it's just natural to feel like we've suffered enough. We shouldn't be going down, that we should be on the upswing. We've got a huge presidential decision to make. Americans do in this country, but there's decisions in every country here. But big picture, why is, and we heard some of it right there from Blanchard, Olivia Blanchard, but why is the global economy, instead of gradually seeing the gears mesh and things begin to move again, as I think you anticipated, why is that not happening? And do you agree with the IMF that we're looking at alarmingly high risks of a downward tumble again?
Well, I think the global risks might be a little bit overstated by the IMF, but they're right that Europe is a total disaster. I think Mr. Blanchard was being very diplomatic when he said uncertainty about what the Europeans are going to do. And the problem, Tom, is that our banks, our big banks, the global mega banks, the top four or five, are way too vulnerable. We didn't put in place the kinds of measures that would make them strong enough to withstand what may be hitting our way now from Europe.
This is still a problem of banking? We thought this was, you know, we were past that, that we were out into job creation and manufacturing and, I don't know, something else, not just we have to roll the tape all the way back still to banking?
Yes, unfortunately and unbelievably, Sheila Bair has a brand new book out, Bull by the Horns, which nails this exactly. She says that Mr. Geithner and other senior Obama officials wanted to put the banks back on their feet, irrespective of how it was done, without enough conditions and without enough capital or enough equity in those banks. Well, she was right in 2008, 2009, and she's right now. This is a key vulnerability for the American economy.
But I still don't get it. Why? Okay, I guess I do. I mean, if there's a run on the banks, but can't we just sort of grow around that problem, get jobs going somehow, get things going? I mean, what takes it back to the banks? In any case, shy of another financial meltdown, why can't we have economic growth even as that sits there? We're not melting down right now financially.
We're not melting down, but the Europeans may be. That's the problem, that there is increasing fear that the eurozone will break up. And if the eurozone breaks up, there's no more euro. All of those contracts, all of those trillions of euros and dollars in contracts with euro countries denominated in euros, all of this becomes a big question mark. Now, our banks are vulnerable directly and indirectly to governments not being able to pay their debt, big banks not being able to pay their debts in Europe, and they need to have stronger buffers, stronger cushions against the losses. That's the equity that you need in any banking system. Mm-hmm. We did not rebuild the equity enough in the American banking system.
Joseph Gagnon, I mean, here we are. What really matters is people want, you know, you've got to eat. You've got to have a roof over your head. You've got to have a job to make those things happen. All of those have been difficult in the U.S. and well beyond for some years now, and people are more than ready for that to be reversed. And instead, here comes this IMF warning, alarmingly high risk of tumbling back the other direction. Where's the globally? Can you point to one country, one region that's the heart of this? Is it Europe's fault, Joe?
Yes. I think quite simply it is Europe that's driving all this right now. People are still not confident that the Europeans are going to solve their problems. And even if they do, as I think they will, the delay that they've taken is just killing the European economy.
Delay they've taken in addressing their loans that they can't meet and debt that they can't handle. So,
well, every month that people in Spain and Italy and the periphery of Europe have to pay these super high interest rates is killing the economy. It's basically killing investment decisions. It's basically stopping spending in those countries and driving them deeper into recession.
So what's the message in that for Americans listening here today, thinking about the decisions to be made here, thinking about the presidential election, thinking about their vote? It's not our problem. It's Europe's problem. There's nothing we can do about it.
Our scope to affect the Europeans is limited. They have all the tools they need to solve their problems. They're wealthy. It's just a matter of political will within Europe, over which we have limited leverage.
So, Simon, what we're sitting over here in our own boat. They're in their boat with their 80% risk of recession. Ours is 15. It doesn't sound so bad, risk, the IMF says. We don't have to worry about it?
Well, we certainly have to worry, and we have to worry partly for trade reasons, because if the European market goes down, that means it's harder for us to export to them and maybe more broadly. But also the financial system, Tom, that's a key linkage, that's a key vulnerability. Derivatives are still very large, extremely opaque, and we don't know what kind of losses could impact large banks or other large financial institutions in the United States. We have not made enough progress in terms of making the financial system more resilient to big outside shocks, such as exactly what's happening now in Europe.
So could we wake up one morning again and it's 2007, 2008 all over again? There's the equivalent of a Lehman quake going on and Wall Street melting down again? I think Americans have the sense that we're past that.
I think that is not high probability in the short term. But certainly a slowdown from our banks, problems in terms of credit, harder for creditworthy people to borrow and creditworthy firms to borrow. These are distinct possibilities given what's happening globally.
Joe, the IMF looking here saying before the 2009 contraction that they'd only had three other global recessions in the whole post-war period, 1975, 1982, 1991. And now they're warning that the odds are rising again. How do we avoid this? We just sit and wait for Europe to figure it out or not? Can we get our individual houses in order? Does that help if China figures it out, if the U.S. figures it out, if the India figures it out?
Well, there are some things we can do, certainly. I think number one would be to avoid going over this fiscal cliff on January 1st, where taxes go up enormously, spending cuts are draconian, and is a massive contraction to the U.S. economy. I think the market seems to feel we will somehow find a way to avoid that, but I would like to do even better than muddle through. I mean, I think all spending cuts and tax increases should be off the table for at least another year because of all the problems in the rest of the world. I think we should obviously solve our fiscal problem in the long run, but given the renewed risks in the world, I think we ought to reduce the fiscal cliff to zero. Markets are expecting it to be cut by a third of a size of it. It's about 4 to 5% of GDP. Markets are expecting 1.5% of GDP cut. That's bad enough. I think it should be zero.
And you're saying that because if we go in with big spending cuts and the tax hikes that many are expecting, that would slow U.S. economic growth.
Yes, and that's what people are expecting. Some cuts as it is, which I think really at this point in time are not a good idea. We should be putting them off one more year at least.
If that's not put off, I mean, here the Tax Policy Center in Washington is saying the average American family could see the average tax bill would go up $3,500, after-tax income drop 6.2%. That sounds like enough to give some kind of punch to the chest of the U.S. economy, Joe.
Yes, it would certainly put us into recession. I think the other thing that we could do, and this feeds into what Simon is saying, is I think the banks and the housing agencies have really not relaxed standards enough for lending to housing. And the administration could have done more, should have done more to prevent that. And I think Simon's right. If banks had had more capital, that would have helped too. But I think even with the capital they have, I think a certain amount of jawboning by the administration and the bank regulators would help to get credit flowing. The housing market is actually poised for recovery right now. It's really the best thing we have going for us. Mortgage rates are at record lows. They'll never be lower. This is a time to tell people, look, with house prices starting to turn up, you better get in the market and buy. And that would be the best thing for the economy, aside from avoiding the fiscal cliff.
Simon, we'll look at it in more detail after a break, but do you see the U.S. presidential dialogue addressing the moment we're at? There's not much there about no spending cuts and no tax hikes for another year. Everybody's saying, no, we've got to face this fiscal cliff, and afraid at the same time we won't.
Well, the good news, Tom, is I think there's a beginning of a serious fiscal conversation, even between the presidential candidates, with Mr. Romney having tax-cutting proposals, mm-hmm. More or less, favoring the better off, and Mr. Obama resisting that and wanting to just raise taxes on people over $250,000 annual income.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the International Monetary Fund warning this week out of Tokyo of what it calls an alarmingly high risk of a new global economic downturn, with the U.S. on its home stretch to a presidential election right in the middle of that. Both candidates talking a lot about the economy lately. Here's Mitt Romney on the campaign trail in Abingdon, Virginia on Friday. Number two on his list to boost America's economy after pursuing energy independence, increased trade, he said.
We have an opportunity to create more jobs by selling our goods and services abroad. So I want to open up more trade with other nations. And if China's stealing jobs unfairly, I'll crack down on China.
Maybe we'll all crack down on each other. Obama's campaign released this video to look to set his policies apart from those of Mitt Romney.
Governor Romney believes that with even bigger tax cuts for the wealthy and fewer regulations on Wall Street, all of us will prosper. In other words, he doubled down on the same trickle-down policies that led to the crisis in the first place.
Everybody's got decisions to make. President Obama saying Mitt Romney would take us back. Simon Johnson is with us, former chief economist at the IMF, now at MIT's Sloan School of Management, author of White House Burning and 13 Bankers. Joseph Gagnon is with us from Washington, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Simon, Joe, lots of feedback on this. I mean, people have been looking at this economy now for a while. They're not, you know, we're not all economists, but everybody's had years now to think about what's going on. And here's one writing to us at our website. Capitalism is a system dependent on ever-increasing growth. The only way infinite growth is possible is by having everything shrink once in a while, says our listener. If it's done quickly, it's a crash. Done slowly, it's a recession. But it will happen. It's just the way capitalism works. We avoided a major reset in 08. The problem is we still need several steps more back before we can go forward again. Do you buy that, Simon?
Not exactly. We did have a big step down in 2008. We're still far below the jobs that we had prior to that crash.
So we've had our shrink, thank you.
We've had a huge shrink. The problem is anemic recovery. We should have bounced back fast. That's what many people predicted, and that was a reasonable expectation from many perspectives. But the IMF's latest projection is 1.7% growth this year. That's fourth quarter on fourth quarter, mm-hmm. and only 2.5% next year. This is total GDP. This is not dynamism. This is not the American economy as we've come to expect. It's profoundly disappointing, and it means fewer jobs.
Joe Gagnon, why has this economy, the global economy, not come back stronger?
Well, our former colleague Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff have written a lot about how economies are different after financial crises, and I think that's something that people have come to accept as an important difference now, is that people, households saw that their house prices fell, but they still had these high debts they'd borrowed, and that really threatened their retirement, their ability to retire. And I think they're sort of what we call repairing their balance sheet, basically saving to build back up their net worth, their retirement nest egg, and that really puts a damper on spending. And so that slows the recovery. And so it's a time when extraordinary fiscal policy is needed as a stopgap measure, and also extraordinarily easy monetary policy is needed. And then a second thing, which I think gets too little play, is that emerging markets also have decided to step up their saving at the same time that households and advanced economies are saving. And so all the saving around the world is really dampening spending, and we need spending to get the economy moving. And so this is the job of government's policies, but they're straining to do enough.
Are policies moving in that direction? I mean, you can just imagine in the last few days as this IMF headline has gone around the world, lots of folks saying, well, let's keep on saving. In fact, let's save a little more. Looks like it may be another rainy day next year. I mean, what do you do with that sentiment, which for each individual family may be quite sensible in the face of headlines like these, Joe?
Exactly. I think it, what sounds sensible for every family and is sensible for every family is not sensible for the world economy as a whole, because saving for the world basically puts people out of work. If you're not spending, then you're going to have to lay people off. And so you need someone to step in and do the spending or encourage others to do the spending. And so governments have moved in this direction enormously, massive fiscal deficits in the U.S., as we know, but they're needed in the short run. And monetary policy has driven interest rates to zero, which is another way to encourage people to spend. And it's just not proven to be enough. That's what's truly extraordinary about where we are now is unusual policies are still not enough.
It's not enough. We're headed for the fiscal cliff. We got a caller from Mystic, Connecticut here. Henry. Henry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My question is, what is the status of these talks or so-called talks about the impending financial cliff that we're headed towards? Are the politicians literally not doing anything and standing by until this one day where we elect somebody, and then they're going to cram something into law before the actual date in between that time and the election? I mean, are we being held hostage until this pretty ambiguous decision? I mean, what's going on with that?
Let's get the sense of our guest today, Simon Johnson. How about it? There's been talk in recent days that something will be done. This won't be allowed to just go forward. Of course, the cliff being big spending cuts and big tax increases at the same time, which everybody says, if that's not addressed, I think you tell me, that would mean recession very likely in this country again. So some kind of deal, everybody's saying, has to happen. But is that still coming together, Simon?
It's certainly still coming together. There's a lot of positioning about what would be in such a deal. Senator Chuck Schumer from New York, very powerful senator, gave a speech yesterday saying he doesn't think there should be a comprehensive tax reform, or he doesn't think that would work along the lines of what happened in 1986. So everyone's moving their chess pieces around. You won't see too much ahead of the presidential election. No party wants to tip their hand too much about exactly what they're willing to put on the table. But between the election and the end of the year, there is a substantial amount of time. I think the good news is they have to do a deal because the economy looks rather too precarious. If you're negligent, if you don't do anything and you charge straight off the cliff, the voters may well hold you accountable down the road. But what exactly is that deal going to be? How much are they going to address taxes? How much they're going to address spending? And as Joe said, how much overall will this tend to contract the economy in the short term? All of this remains unclear.
Joe, what about it? I mean, Schumer sort of planted a new flag here, as it was reported, saying any tax overhaul should freeze the top two personal income tax rates, not drop them, as Mitt Romney would say. Of course, Schumer's a Democrat. Should hold the middle class harmless. Can we really do that? And should raise rates on capital gains to close the difference between earned and unearned income. If you hold the flag right there, can we get a deal, Joe?
Yes, I think there's two things. There's a short run, there's a long run. I think in the long run, we can do it mainly, as Schumer said, through tax increases, holding the middle class largely harmless, but aggressively tackling health care costs, which are really the main long-run problem we face. So some kind of cost efficiency, not, you know, spending money on wasteful procedures, that will go the longest way towards the long-run problem. In the short run, I think we need to really reassess how much should be done next year. I think we should really scale back. The market thinks we're going to do a moderate cut of 1.5% of GDP. That's still pretty strong. I think right now that should really be zero.
You know,
I think we should do nothing next year.
First, do no harm. Simon, as I hear these things, okay, to fix it, we've got to what? We've got to fix bank capitalization, you say. Joe says we've got to fix health care costs. Everybody says we've got to fix the tax system and tax reform. And pretty soon, I look at that list of things, and I just feel like, you know what? We are not up to that. We're not going to get that done. We're in trouble.
Well, we're not going to get that done. There won't be a comprehensive package of reforms, even within the tax spending nexus, let alone with bank capital and with healthcare costs. That's not going to happen. The question is, so there'll be some sort of muddling through. The question is, how much damage does that do to the economy? What sort of traumatic political debate do you have? Remember the damage that was done last summer in the fight over the debt ceiling, when the screaming and shouting and a lot of destabilization that goes on, that actually hurts the rest of the world in many ways as much as it hurts us. If you want to put pressure on the Europeans, mm-hmm. if you want to further push their economies into recession, best thing to do would be to have a debilitating political fight at the end of this year about the U.S. fiscal issues, because that will cause interest rates to go up on anything regarded as risky around the world.
Joe, is that fair that some of this fever, some of the problem is emanating from the U.S.? Maybe it's not Europe's fault. Maybe it's our battle on the cliff here.
Oh, we've contributed. I think, you know, it's 80% Europe and 20% U.S. right mm-hmm. now. And it could get worse, as Simon says. I think it's possible we will literally go over the cliff and not reach a deal until January, which would be bad for the economy, albeit temporary. But there is some encouraging news lately. A number of Republican congressmen have been hinting that maybe they will let some of the high-income tax cuts expire, that maybe that will be a requirement of the deal. And the other thing is that whoever wins a presidential election will have some capital or some sense that things should go slightly more his way, that sort of the voters have spoken. I think there will be a deal, but I wish, you know, it didn't have to wait till the last minute.
I've got to tell you, Simon's looking pretty skeptical about that the compromise you described. We'll look at that. Alex in Medford, Massachusetts. Alex, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I could make my comment quite long, but I want to keep it very short.
Okay.
This is the classic rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic conversation. We have not, as a global community, addressed the issue of our using real resources at a greater rate than they can provide over the long term, and a population growth issue, and more specifically, a whole generation of people that have retired that are living off of an economic base that can't afford to keep this up sustainably. So
yep.
I'm just throwing out a lot of very broad problems, and capitalism has always been generated by growth, and you can't grow on a finite planet forever. It eventually catches up to you. I think we're at a tipping point right now. I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks very much. You know, Simon, Joseph, I have to say lots and lots of comments at our website are along this line. You guys, you're economists. You've got a million ways to discuss this. A lot of people sit back and do a more elementary kind of calculus, and you heard it right there, that all this growth is resource intensive. There's too many people. There are too few resources, and we're just outrunning the basic formula of capitalism. How do you respond to that, Simon? It is a very, very commonly feared dynamic, to judge by the comments I'm looking at here online.
Oh, I agree, Tom. I hear this a lot, and I think there's genuine fear and some good analysis behind some of this reasoning. I would point out that our ability to use energy more efficiently, for example, is
hypothetical capacity to do that.
Yes, our capacity to do
or
that.
More than.
And what we've done, the way we've improved energy efficiency, if you look at what was forecast in terms of energy use for the United States today, go back, see what the forecasts were 10, 20, 30 years ago, those forecasts were wrong because they thought we'd be using a lot more energy mm-hmm. than we are now. If we wanted to move towards becoming more energy efficient and do that through investments in technology, for example, and do that through gradually phasing in a higher price for carbon or a gasoline tax, pushing over 20 years the vehicle fleet to become more fuel efficient. All of these things are entirely possible and consistent with continued growth. I'm not sure they're going to happen. We don't have a very rational political process around these kinds of decisions. And, of course, we have discovered an awful lot of shale gas, which has driven energy prices for natural gas down.
Mm-hmm.
And the same
fossil
thing may happen to other parts of energy prices, too. And then we may become less efficient. So I think these are legitimate concerns. They are not, at the moment, the number one break on economic growth. That is the massive disturbance to the world economy caused by European policy mistakes.
Joseph Gagnon there in Washington. What about our callers? List of horribles here. We're using up our resources. Our population growth is off the charts. Our demographics have the old depending on the young. The young can't afford it. It's capitalism versus the planet, and it's not working. What about that perspective?
I think it has some merit, especially in a few places around the world, some of the poorer countries that still have high population growth. But I actually think, as Simon said, I agree completely with what Simon said. One of the things, you know, I'm not a market absolutist. I accept that the free market doesn't work very well in healthcare and we need much more government intervention. But one place the free market does work is in use of natural resources and energy. If we if something becomes scarcer, it's amazing how inventive we have shown ourselves to be at finding alternatives and conserving on it. And, you know, and Japan is a very rich country and uses about half as much energy per person as we do. So it's clear that we could use less if we wanted to and still have a high standard of living. I don't see this as a major problem for the U.S. going forward. And if anything, as Simon said, we're actually in the midst of an energy boom right now with these massive new shale gas and shale oil discoveries. So if anything, I fear the opposite problem for the U.S. is we'll become too profligate and wasteful.
Okay, so maybe there's a way on energy, but channel the rest of Alex's message there. I mean, I imagine him sitting thinking right now, yeah, that's maybe on energy, maybe. What about water, enough land to grow the food, enough you know, rare earth metals and all the rest as you go down the list of resources? You know, the fear that there's just not enough to go around and the system that has brought such prosperity isn't up to it anymore, Joe.
Well, you see, when things become scarce, the price goes up and we learn how to economize and we find alternatives. And that's just the story of history. Mm-hmm. And most of the value that we think of as generating our standard of living is not natural resources. It's about 5% natural resources. It's about 95% human effort and human ingenuity embodied in capital and labor. So, you know, we can continue to be wealthy with half the resources we're using now if we need to. We could use far less resources if we needed to. We just don't need to yet. So when that happens, we'll deal with it. I just don't think this is the problem.
Simon?
Well, I think Alex does make a good point about the demographic shift. And some of these European countries, in addition to all their macroeconomic short-run problems, mm-hmm. have a bad demographic. They're aging societies. Japan, the population is declining over the next 30 years, mm-hmm. and they already have a huge amount of government debt. That is a powder keg. The United States doesn't have that demographic as long as we continue to have the kind of natural rate of population growth of people in the United States and immigration. Immigration, of course, though, is partly driven by economic opportunity. Mm-hmm. If the economy goes down and stays down for a long time, fewer people come to the United States, fewer young people come to the United States.
And that's been going on out of Mexico, certainly, we read.
Absolutely. Last 5 years have not been good for immigration. People are pulled by the opportunities. What you want is more younger people working hard, as people do in America. That will support the aging of the population. But if we have a 5 or 10 year slowdown, that's not going to happen. And those longer run problems around paying for retirement are going to become more acute.
So, and the straight up resources side of this beyond energy, you know, is there enough of everything else to keep it going? Do you agree with Joe that we just get more ingenious about how we use each of those minerals and inputs?
In the United States, we have a good track record of responding to prices. And when things become more scarce and prices go up, we have innovated. In other parts of the world, that hasn't happened. You have deforestation, you have very bad problems of overpopulation and pollution. And you know, that's affecting one-third to one-half of the world's population. So in those parts of the world, I would worry a great deal. We should look at technology investments that will help us and help them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking today at the IMF warning of what it calls an alarmingly high risk of a new global economic downturn, with the U.S. on its home stretch to a presidential election. Simon Johnson is with us, former chief economist at the IMF, now professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Joseph Gagnon is here from Washington, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Lots of pressure in and out of Europe. Here was German Chancellor Angela Merkel yesterday in Greece. Thousands in Athens came out to protest her first visit there in some time. Here's an English voiceover on Merkel.
Despite the fact that this is a difficult path, I think it is going to prove worthwhile for Greece. For if you would not attend to solving the problems now, they would recur at a later point in time in a much more dramatic way.
Fix it now, or it will hit us later in a much more dramatic way. Angela Merkel saying there are thousands in the streets. Joseph Gagnon, Simon Johnson's really worried about the banks. If Europe doesn't get it together, is that the way it hits the U.S.? If they've got 80% chance of a slowdown there, is it lost markets for us, or is the major risk to American banks getting wobbly under pressure out of Europe? What?
I guess I wouldn't discount some risk to the banks, but I guess I would have thought the major risk is they're not going to buy our exports and they're mm-hmm. a big trading partner for us. But also general financial markets are linked so that if their stock market goes down, our stock market goes down because we have big multinational corporations based in the U.S. who have big operations in Europe and their profits go down even if their exports don't go down as much. So it affects us in many ways through financial conditions, optimism, exports, and U.S. banks who have some exposure there too.
Simon, I guess you've been at the IMF. I don't see how they can say 80% risk of a downturn in Europe and 15% here if we're so intertwined. How can theirs be so high and ours so low?
Well, that's a good question. They're about a third of the world economy. We're about a quarter of the world economy. Most of the balance is in the so-called emerging markets part of the world. And those economies remain relatively strong. They're slowing down a bit, and that's part of what was in the IMF's mm-hmm. revision that's got people's attention. But it's not the case that the entire economy is turning negative. Europe's going negative. Emerging markets are slowing down. The U.S., if anything, is pushing the other way. The IMF forecast has the U.S. going up a little bit next year in terms of growth compared to this year.
Still relatively slow growth, 2-point-something, but
2.5. It's anemic. It's not enough jobs. No question. It's not good news for the United States. Mm. But the European situation is not yet so dire or so cataclysmic that it will pull us down. If it gets a lot worse, if they really bungle the next couple of rounds of what they need to do in terms of restructuring their currency union, then it could really push us into recession also.
And Sean in New Haven, Connecticut. Sean, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Don. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My question for your guest is in regards to China. I wanted to know if their expected downturn that's going to come up is going to have a good or bad effect on either Europe or the U.S.
Let us pick it up. Joe, what do you say? China.
Well, it's hard to say because a lot of growth in China and the emerging markets has actually come at the expense of the U.S. In other words, they have increased net trade to the U.S., and that's driven some of their growth. And to the extent that they grow slower because that's unwinding, which it has in the past couple of years, that's not bad for the U.S. But if they do slow down a lot more, and that is a risk, then presumably that would start to hurt the U.S. because that would reduce their growth in the U.S. in China. That is buying some exports for the U.S. for infrastructure projects and stuff where we sell Caterpillar tractors, et cetera, that might be hurt.
But you can hear Sean wondering, I think, there in his tone of voice, if maybe that would bring jobs back home.
Well, that's the thing. I think up to now it has been doing that because their exports to us have been falling relative to their imports. So the balance of trade is getting more in line, which is good. And that can go a little bit further, and that will be good for us. But again, if demand collapses in China, if they stop these massive projects, infrastructure projects, and development projects, that would be bad for us. So it really depends on how far it goes.
Mitt Romney has made a lot of China's what he charges as currency manipulation. I think you've said you see that much more widely than just China. Can that be taken on in such a way that it puts jobs back in the U.S., or do we just end up hurting economies abroad in this global economy that we need as markets?
Well, so here is where, and I don't know if Simon will agree, I've been kind of saying that I think this is one of the biggest unknown factors going on, unnoticed factors, is that China, and not just China, by the way, it's a lot of emerging markets, most of the emerging world, and even a couple advanced economies, are all massively spending money to hold their currencies down to keep their exports up. And that does hurt the U.S. economy. So it would be better, and they have room to maneuver. They could stop doing this and get growth through easier monetary policy by lowering interest rates and reforms at home that encourage consumption and investment at home. That would help everybody, and that is a better path for the world. I think that has been talked about a lot less. I'm surprised because I estimate that over $1 trillion a year is basically distorted trade away from U.S. and Europe towards China and emerging markets.
But if that's so obvious, why doesn't China do it?
Well, it's not obvious. I mean, they've been happy with what they've been doing. I'm saying that it can't continue forever, and they will be better in the long run to stop it. And they have slowed down, by the way. I want to give China credit. They have let the renminbi rise. They have slowed their purchases of U.S. assets, and they have reduced their current account surplus, their trade surplus. So that's all good. And it's a question of how much more can it go, and what about other countries that are still doing this? We need all emerging markets to sort of realize that they need to grow domestically. They need to grow through investment and consumption at home and not through just exporting to the U.S. and Europe.
Let's go to John in New Orleans, Louisiana. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a large paperback book written by the Federal Reserve after the collapse of the banks in the 80s.
Okay.
And from time to time, I open it up and read a few pages, and I don't see any difference from the lessons taught and lessons learned of the 80s than what's going on right now, except it was commercial loans which bagged the banks back in the 80s, and this time around, it's the home loans. No difference. I haven't found any difference at all in all this large, voluminous writings of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed, is my opinion, since that particular time.
We had an S&L crisis there. We had another banking crisis and then some since then. I mean, Simon, where are we on that learning curve?
We're not in a good place, Tom. John's absolutely right. We had the crisis of the S&Ls in the 1980s. Before that, we had a crisis on so-called third world debt, emerging mm-hmm. market debt. So mm-hmm. there were two significant banking crises in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. The banks were put back on their feet. There weren't sufficient controls put in place. Their incentives remained very dangerous. And actually, they went out and took risks that were much larger relative to the economy in the 2000s, and that's what blew up in our face around residential mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
So he's absolutely right that we learned very, very little, and the Federal Reserve, with all due respect to Joe and others who worked in the Federal Reserve, unfortunately didn't see the bubble building, didn't understand the risks developing inside the financial sector, and I'm worried that going forward the same sort of thing can happen again.
So I know this is your hobby horse. This is your nightmare, the sort of problem with the banks. And yet I think people look around and say, yes, we've taken hit after hit, but things have kept on going. Is there some fundamental new structure to global banking you'd like to see? Would the way the economy works feel different to an ordinary consumer if all of your reforms were implemented, Simon?
Yes, the banks should become small enough and simple enough to fail. End this too big to fail nonsense and distortion. It's a form of subsidy. The government is backing up these banks implicitly, so if they get into trouble, they'll be bailed out and their creditors will be protected. That encourages them to go out and take reckless risks. That's absolutely what blew up in our face in 2008. That's a big part of what the Europeans are dealing with now.
Mm-hmm.
We mustn't go there again, and we should be pushing further in terms of financial reform and strengthening the capital, strengthening the equity in our financial system, precisely to insulate us from big shocks that come from all over the world.
So Americans have a decision to make, Romney, Obama. How do you look at the messages you're hearing from those two camps on this issue of the structure of the banks, how they ought to be handled? From your view as an economist, has one got a better idea than another, a better plan?
They're both pretty bad, frankly. Mr. Obama missed opportunity after opportunity. He did push through the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation. Some parts of that are sensible. I don't think it goes far enough. Mr. Romney says he would repeal and replace Dodd-Frank. He doesn't say what he would replace it with, so that makes me very nervous. Both campaigns take a lot of money from Wall Street. The Republicans take a little bit more, but the Democrats have been very closely aligned with the big banks' interests over the past 4 years.
So what's it going to take if what happened in 08 was not enough to shake us into doing something?
I don't know. Let's see what happens in Europe and let's see the consequence of that. Back in the financial reform debate, the 2009-2010, some people said, oh, big banks are fine. Look at how good Europe is. Mm-hmm. Well, nobody makes that point anymore.
No, I guess they don't. Dee in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Dee, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I used to work for the Defense Logistics Agency. That's mm-hmm. the civilian arm of the military that deals with controlling contracts with contractors.
Yeah.
And when I was working for the DLA, I saw that there was huge cost overruns and things of this nature in contracts that contractors were using to basically as a slush fund, and the government continued to pay them if they wound up not hitting schedules and dates of delivery and
yep,
so on
yep.
and so forth. And built into the contracts themselves, there's certain things where there's supposed to be capital improvements in facilities and things like this for making the company operate much more efficiently. And these were just huge slush funds.
Well, maybe so, but maybe, I mean, and a lot of people would like to see those defense budgets cut, I suppose, but I guess maybe even slush funds equal jobs, D, or not?
Well, the thing is that the slush fund is that they're actually producing the product, but they're getting much more money than they should be getting. Everybody is talking about, cutting entitlements, Mm-hmm. Well, the military has become an entitlement type of system.
In itself. Look there for cuts. We'll look at that, Dee, and I appreciate your report on that experience. Simon, what about, there's a big piece, military spending. Mitt Romney says we've got to spend more. President Obama says we've got to cut some. Dee says it's so full of inefficiency, we ought to be spending it better. It's, you know, it's an entitlement like anything else these days.
Well, actually, I'm surprised by Mr. Romney's line on this. What you hear from most of the people near the top of the Pentagon is that if you phase in military cuts over 10 or 20 years, then it would be reasonable to spend less as a percent of the economy. And I think the points that Dee's making are entirely reasonable and well documented. The question is how much do you want to do in a dramatic fashion at the beginning of next year? And I think the increasingly people want to postpone those cuts and push those back. But the idea of reducing military spending, actually, I find that to be one of the few items on the fiscal agenda where you have a lot of bipartisan agreement.
So let's look at these two candidates, and they're standing up in front of the American people now asking for votes, and that's coming up very soon. Joseph Cañon, when you look at Barack Obama, President Obama, when you look at Mitt Romney, do you see what's the most important distinction you draw when you look at how they're tacking on economic plans?
I think the most important thing that I see is that President Obama has put forward a path to deficit reduction that seems balanced to me. Has some revenue increases, including on high-income earners, looking for loophole cuts to the extent possible, but also some spending cuts, and willing to tackle the long-run healthcare costs we face. Whereas Romney seems to be very much focused on no revenue increases, all spending cuts, but not defense, which seems totally distorted and skewed to me. So that's the biggest thing. One thing, though, where I do like Romney, I guess, given what I just said, is he's more aggressively free trade, at the same time more aggressive about people who are cheating on the rules. He mentions China. I wish he wouldn't only pick on China, but I like the fact that he seems to get that is important.
Do you think he's more or less likely than President Obama to help us avert a new downturn and turn up? He's got a very optimistic tone when he talks about the economy.
Well, you know, it was sort of leaked in this famous 47% tape that basically what he told investors was, or donors was, my plan really is just that businesses will like me more than Obama, and once I'm elected, they'll, you know, jump up and down and cheer and spend lots of money and hire people to work. Well, that's his plan, basically. People will like me better. Businesses will like me better, so they'll spend more.
Is that possible? Maybe he's right. What do you say to that?
Well, he may be right. I don't know. But it's really doesn't sound like a plan to me. And it's just a hope. And, it just strikes me as not a good selling point.
They like me. Simon Johnson, you're shaking your head. Obama on the one hand, Romney on the other, Americans sitting with a decision to make. What about the economy looking forward? Where do you see a more persuasive plan?
Well, I'm not very happy with either candidate, frankly, Tom. I think on the fiscal side, Joe put it well. You need to balance it. You need to have some revenue on the table. You need to have some spending cuts on the table. The military spending absolutely has to be on the table. I would be more aggressive in pushing for deficit reduction in a balanced manner, and I would want more revenue. And I think the middle class tax cuts that people are regarding as being somehow untouchable, unfortunately, it's very hard to bring the budget over 20 years under control unless you're willing to address those taxes.
Joe says don't touch it now, for heaven's sakes.
Well, I understand the situation right now is difficult. I think you need to do something right now. The problem is if you wait a year, the European economy is still going to be bad in a year. Wait 2 years, I think it could still be bad in 2 years. 3-5 years. So when exactly are you going to start? But I take the point, you don't want to do anything too dramatic. It'd be much better if we could have a political consensus, some revenue increases, some tax increases. And that's where the Republican and some spending points, particularly on healthcare, as Joe said. The problem is the Republicans have consistently resisted any notion of really raising revenue. through higher tax rates on anyone, and that right now is increasingly problematic. So I think on balance, I would go with Obama on the fiscal side while holding my nose.
So you don't see some kind of magic? Mitt Romney says, look, they're going to like me, and the coffers will open up, and everything will be rock and roll again.
I think that's wishful thinking.
You know, people these days may be vulnerable to wishful thinking because some of these warnings are so frightening, and the pain has been deep enough, long enough already. It may just be looking for wishful thinking, but wishful thinking doesn't make it rain.
Wishful thinking is what got us into this mess, Tom. Tax cuts, not without worrying about the consequences. Foreign wars are expensive. Expanding Medicare Part D, didn't pay for that. And the huge financial crisis because we wished that the banks would behave themselves. And, of course, they didn't.
We're eyes wide open today. Simon Johnson with the MIT Sloan School of Management, author of White House Burning, 13 Bankers. Thanks very much for being with us, Simon.
Thank you.
And Joseph Cagnon at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Thank you so much, Joe.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.